Good morning.
I'm afraid I could do 52 sermons on this subject rather than the four I plan on doing, and I probably won't learn as much as I need to. I struggle with patience a lot. It's good to see you all here this morning, and we welcome those joining us on Facebook. I hope you all have had a good week. We are starting a new series this morning, all under that umbrella that we introduced last week of fixing our eyes on Jesus. And so, well, with that in mind, I think I've said it on a Sunday night or two, maybe even on a Sunday morning, I think it's okay for us being okay that things aren't okay. Whether you're watching at home or you're sitting in this room, or maybe you're thinking about what's going on around the country or around the world, or maybe you're just thinking about what's going on in your own personal life, I think it's okay for us to admit that right now things just are not okay. They are not all right. But fixing our eyes on Jesus allows us to be okay with things not being okay. And that's what we're going to spend time talking about this month. That we could admit that everything's not okay, everything's not the way that I want it to be, but I'm okay. And I'm okay with things not being okay because my eyes are fixed on Jesus. And so with my eyes fixed on Jesus, I can be patient. I can endure. I can be steadfast. I can wait for the Lord. One of the things that undermines patience are platitudes. And you know what a platitude is, a cliche, an axiom, things that seem true, things that seem very common sense. They seem self-evidently true. What one of those things that we used to say as a kid, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me, right? I mean, that sounds common sense. It sounds so obvious. Sticks and stones, yes, they would break my bones, but words, they just bounce right off me. Those things can't hurt me. That sounds fine, right? Until somebody says something mean to you, right? Then guess what? Words do hurt. That's just a platitude, a cliche, an axiom that sounds good and fine, but it's hollow. And when things get hard and tough, then our platitudes get challenged, and guess what? Sometimes they don't carry us through. It takes more than platitudes to persevere, and that's what this month's series is going to be about, challenging those things. And so that's what today's lesson is about, challenging those thoughts that seem so obvious and so true. And we kind of build our house on them, just like Jesus' Sermon on the Mount ends, that we sometimes realize then that we've built our house on sand. One of those platitudes that we tend to say is God helps those who do what? Who help themselves, right? We've heard that. We've probably even said that. God helps those who help themselves. And in fact, that saying goes all the way back to ancient Greece, into Aesop's fables. Then it got carried into modern thinking, and we tend to just assume that is true. God helps those who help themselves. And what we mean by that is that if you work really hard, and you do everything you can, and you're a good person, and you live a comfortable and you live a healthy life, then God will also show up and he will help you. And then we kind of look around, and when things are going well for us, and we ask, why am I so blessed? And we say, well, because God is good. And because I've made some really good choices, I've done things the right way, and because I've worked hard and I've made good choices and I've done things the right way, then God has shown up and he's blessed me. And so we kind of thank God and we kind of thank ourselves, and that sort of theology, those platitudes, those cliches, they work as long as everything is pretty comfortable. And as long as we're pretty comfortable, we can say that I'm comfortable and I'm healthy and I'm happy because, again, I've made good choices. And because we've made good choices, God's blessed us. Because why? God helps those who help themselves. You can turn on your TV just about any time of the day and you can find a preacher who is preaching a message that is a whole lot like that. You make good choices. You have positive thoughts. You do good things. And God's going to show up and bless you, and you will be successful and happy and healthy, and God will help you if you think the right thoughts and do the right things and say the right things, then you'll be successful and happy and healthy, and have a prosperity-ridden life. And that sort of thinking makes sense as long as things are comfortable. But as soon as things aren't comfortable, as soon as the suffering begins, as soon as the theology is challenged, as soon as we begin to have hardship and we start to wonder what went wrong, and then we start to suffer and we say, well, maybe I'm at fault. Maybe I did something wrong. Maybe I'm to blame for some suffering. And then if we look around and we say, I don't get it. What could I have possibly done? There are probably people here this morning, maybe in this room, maybe watching online, but certainly some of your friends and some of your family that are wondering right now, what did I do wrong to deserve what I am going through? And really that's because they've sort of built their life on this sort of platitude, on this sort of idea that God helps those who helps themselves. And if God is not helping you, then you haven't done your part and you haven't worked hard enough and you haven't been good enough. And so they start to blame themselves. Or they may look around long enough and say, well, I don't know what I did, so maybe it was God. Maybe it's God that's mean, or maybe God isn't real. There are a lot of people that do not believe in God anymore because they built their life on this sort of theology, on that sort of platitude. But maybe there's a third option, that we don't necessarily blame ourselves and we don't blame God, but we begin to blame our bad theology. And we start to look and say, well, maybe something is wrong with our thinking, with our theology, with our platitudes. Maybe suffering often accompanies faithfulness. Maybe when we are faithful to God, we have to go through hard things. And so maybe something hasn't gone wrong. Maybe this is the way things are supposed to be. Maybe this is the course that is laid out before us. And what, that's what we find in the book of Job. If you look at Job 1, you're probably familiar with this story. We're going to go through it just a little bit. Job 1:1 says, there was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and the man was blameless and upright, who feared God and turned away from evil. There were born to him 7 sons and 3 daughters. He possessed 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 5,000 yoke of oxen, and 500 female donkeys, and very many servants, so that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. He's incredibly rich, incredibly comfortable. He's worked hard. He's made the right decisions. He's done the right things. Job has served God. He's took care of poor people. He's done generous things. He's good and upright. Things are going well. And again, it would be really easy to kind of think in this context, I have all of this stuff because I've made some really good decisions. And God helps those who help themselves, and that's why I have all of this stuff. People respected him. He was well thought of. And then verse 7 says that the Lord said to Satan, from where have you come from? And Satan answered the Lord, I have from going to and fro on the earth and from walking up and down it. And the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil? Then Satan turned to the Lord and said, does Job fear God for no reason? Have you not put a hedge around him and his house and all that he has on every side? You've blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand. Stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face. This story really gets to the heart of bad theology, the kind of theology that most people tend to have, a theology that is very transactional, a theology that believes in a transcendent God that is a very transactional God, a God that's way up there, that doesn't really care about people, that doesn't really have a relationship with people, and a God who, if you do the right things, he's going to give you the right blessings. He's sort of like a heavenly vending machine, and if you put all the right things in it and you make all the right choices and you believe all the right things, then God is going to dispense with his blessings. And Satan is saying to God, that's exactly how Job is. He's nothing special. He's not upright. He's no different than anybody else. The only reason why he loves you and fears you is because he's using you. He's just like everybody else. He's transactional. He's doing what he's doing because you give him all the good stuff. Take away the good stuff and he's going to curse you to your face. He's just like everybody else. This story ought to cause us to look in the mirror, because Satan is saying about Job that he really doesn't love you for you, God. He loves you for the stuff that you give him. And so, of course, Satan puts Job to the test. His donkey and his oxen are stolen. His servants are killed. Fire comes from the sky and kills the sheep and the shepherds. Raiding armies or parties come in and steal his camels. And worst of all, a storm comes and destroys his son's house, killing all of his children. And we could go into all of these things and realize that this is Satan doing these things. But look at verse 20. It says, then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head and fell on the ground and worshiped. He worshiped. He said, naked I came from my mother's womb and naked I shall return. The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. In all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. Job is proving he has a unique theology, a unique relationship with God, a relationship with God that is different than most people. This is why Job is unique. This is why he's outstanding and why he was different, because his relationship with God wasn't transactional. His relationship with God was relational. He loved God for God. Job didn't know what was going on behind the scenes. He didn't know what Satan was up to. He had no idea. And even at the end of the book, he still has no idea about this conversation between God and Satan. But Job loves God for God. And Job says, whatever happens, all of my stuff is gone, all of my riches are gone, my children are gone, but I will worship God and I will remain devoted to him. Certainly not because of what he gives me, and not because of a hedge of protection that he's put around me, but because I love him. And Satan says, yeah, but you still haven't hit him, God, where it hurts. Let me attack his flesh. Let me attack his health. Then he will curse you. And so in chapter 2, verse 7, it says, Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with loathsome sores from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took a piece of broken pottery with which to scrape himself, and he sat in ashes. Then his wife said to him, do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die. And now, we could look at Job's wife and say what a horrible woman she was, but wait a second. She's exactly like most of us. She's exactly like most people who see God as being very transactional. God helps those who help themselves. She knew Job. She knew Job had helped himself. She knew Job had done everything right. Job had done the good things. Job had been the man he was supposed to be, and yet everything was falling apart, including his own health. And so Job's wife asked the same question that most people ask. What good has it done? What good has it done to be devoted to God, to do the right things, to be the right kind of person, if this is how you're going to end up? Curse God and die. What's the use in putting your prayers into this vending machine if you aren't getting any blessings out? The problem is that's not how a relationship is supposed to work. And Job understood that. That God isn't a heavenly vending machine. His wife didn't know that. His wife didn't understand. Most people didn't. Most people don't. Most people continue to build their ideas on the idea that God helps those who help themselves. If I do all the hard work and I make all the right choices, and I'm going to be comfortable and prosperous and healthy. We've got to start challenging those platitudes, because you cannot persevere through suffering on platitudes. It takes more than platitudes to persevere. You cannot be like Job if you build your house on the sinking sand of God helps those who help themselves. If I work hard enough and believe the right things, I'm going to be healthy and prosperous. That's not the way life works. Job says to her in verse 10, you speak of one of the foolish women would speak, or you speak as one of the foolish women would speak. Shall we receive good from God, and shall we not receive evil? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Again, Job doesn't know what's going on behind the scenes. He simply says, I'm not giving up so easy. I'm not giving up. I'm going to persevere. I am going to endure. And of course, then Job's friends show up. And they're the same as Job has always been, rich and prosperous. They've lived comfortable lives. Their lives are going pretty good for them. They are firmly planted on these platitudes. Job's friends have earthly wisdom, and they think, hey, Job, it's pretty obvious. God helps those who help themselves, and your life is a mess. You must not be helping yourself. Fix yourself. Do something. Change what you're doing or what you're believing, because you're obviously wrong. People's lives don't fall apart unless they've done something wrong, because God helps those who help themselves, and they continue to double down and double down on this sort of bad theology. And so in chapter 2, verse 21, they said, agree with God and be at peace. Thereby good will come to you. God helps those, Job, who help themselves. And if you could read a lot of what Job's friends say, and you could say, that actually sounds kind of right. It kind of sounds wise, because we tend to believe those same sort of cliches and platitudes and axioms. Maybe not when we're reading the book of Job, but when we're doing it in real life, we certainly do. We just build our house on these shallow, hollow thoughts of earthly wisdom. But Job calls his friends worthless physicians. And the sort of medicine that they are trying to dole out are things like proverbs of ashes and defenses of clay and empty nothings. Sometimes we have to stop and ask ourselves, are these things empty nothings? Are they the same sort of things that pass as religious wisdom today? The same sort of religious wisdom that we build our house on today? They sound okay when things are going well, when things are comfortable, when we are healthy and happy, but when things start to fall apart and the storms start to roll in, those sort of platitudes begin to collapse, and you realize that they're nothing. That they're empty nothings, and you can't persevere on platitudes. You can't be like Job, because real patience, real endurance requires a selfless willingness to suffer, an acknowledgement that sometimes suffering accompanies faithfulness. I think if we get nothing else from the story of Job, and there's a whole lot that we could explore with Job, but I think if we get nothing else from the story of Job, we have to realize that sometimes suffering accompanies faithfulness. Sure, sometimes you're suffering because you've been sinful and something is wrong. Sometimes something does need to be corrected, and if that's the case, correct it. But sometimes suffering accompanies faithfulness. That's the sort of theology we need to embrace. That's the sort of theology that revolves around the cross. The cross ought to teach us that sometimes suffering accompanies faithfulness. We have to have the kind of devotion that Job had. He says in chapter 13, verse 15, though he slay me, I will hope in him. Job says that throughout the book, he probably, I think, goes too far and repents of charging God with wrong. But Job says, I don't understand why this is happening, but he perseveres. He's steadfast. He endures because for him, his relationship with God wasn't transactional. Job says, I'm going to be devoted to him. I'm going to persevere. I'm going to be patient. I'm going to wait on the Lord to show up and to show me what's going on. And I'm not going to give up, because my hope is in him. And so we'll look at the way that James applies this to Christians. In James chapter 5, verse 7, he says, be patient, therefore, brothers. Until when? Until your ship comes in? Until this disease goes away? Until I get more money? Until when? Until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, being patient about it until he receives the early and the late rains. You also be patient, establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. Establish is a good word. Make it firm. Make your hearts firm so that they cannot take our hearts and give them away to empty nothings. We cannot make our hearts firm on empty platitudes. We can't make our hearts firm on earthly wisdom. Only in the gospel Can we make our hearts firm? Verse 9 says, don't grumble against one another, brothers, so that you may not be judged. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. As an example of suffering and patience, brothers, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. Every single prophet who suffered, there wasn't a single one of them who said, if I just got my life together, things would be so much more comfortable. Never. Jeremiah, when he was down in the pit, he didn't say, you know what? This is really my fault. If I had just had more positive thoughts and if I had just been a better person, I wouldn't be going through this. That didn't happen because Jeremiah recognized, Isaiah recognized, every prophet of God recognized that sometimes suffering accompanies faithfulness. This is part of what it looks like to be faithful to God. And they waited for God. And they were patient. James says in verse 11, behold, we consider those blessed who remain steadfast. You have heard of the steadfastness of Job, and you have seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful. At the end of the story, God gives Job twice as much as he lost. And God will do the same for us. He will give twice as much as anything that we have lost, but we have to wait for the Lord. Not wait for a day or wait for the end of the year or wait for whatever to end. Wait for the coming of the Lord. Wait for the Lord to show up. And that might not happen in your lifetime, but it will happen. We have to be patient until then. We have to endure until then. We have to recognize that sometimes suffering accompanies faithfulness until then. And we have to be okay with things not being okay. That's what it looks like to follow Jesus, to being steadfast and patient, to having hearts that are established, to, as James starts in his book in chapter 1 by saying, to consider it a joy when we encounter various trials. This is the message of the cross. The message of the cross is not that God helps those who help themselves. That's not the message of the cross. If you believe the right things and do the right things and have the right attitude, then you don't have to go through bad stuff. That is not the message of the cross. The message of the cross is that God helps those who patiently endure suffering, waiting for him. The message of the cross is that God helps those who remain steadfast under trial. The message of the cross is that God helps those who sacrifice their own good to help others. The message of the cross is God helps those who faithfully wait for his help. Sometimes the only thing that can fix a situation is waiting. Sometimes the only thing that can fix a situation is God showing up. So we must endure. We must be patient. We must be okay with things not being okay. So here's where I want us to land this morning, that the patience of Job takes more than platitudes. It takes fixing our eyes on Jesus. And when we fix our eyes on Jesus, we see that what happened to him will happen to us. Suffering, yes. Glorification, yes. Resurrection, yes. What happened to Jesus will happen to us. We have to take up our cross and follow him. But we will be raised. And we will share in his glory if we are willing to suffer what he suffered. If we're willing to wait how he waited. If we're willing to be rejected as he was rejected. To be patient as he was patient. That's the message of the cross. And if we build our house on these empty nothings, on empty platitudes, then when the storm comes, our houses will collapse. Those platitudes will work great when things are good, but as long as there's no suffering. But when the suffering comes, that's when it doesn't work out anymore. God doesn't help those who help themselves. But soon, as soon as it starts to rain and the earth starts to quake and the suffering comes, we do realize those are just empty nothings, and we need Jesus. And as we said, the theme for this year, fix our eyes on Jesus. That's the journey that begins with baptism, and that's the journey that we recommit ourselves to every week and every day as followers of Jesus. And so if we can help you this morning to commit your life to Jesus, pray for you, encourage you, help you put on Jesus in baptism, whatever your need may be, please come as together we stand and we sing.